Hello and welcome to Volume 162 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss a new service that reports wood product prices. We'll learn more about what landowners can do and not do to promote healthy deer populations. We'll discuss prescribed burn associations, and we'll hear from the perspective of a forest owner who owns land both in the United States and in Germany. This program is brought to you by Forester Search. It's a service that makes it easier to connect forest landowners with consulting foresters who can help you through your next steps that you'll face as a forest landowner. You can find it at foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page. I'm Hayes Brown, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. This may be a first for Capital Ideas Live, our first interview with a forest owner who owns land in Georgia and Germany. Leon Mangasarian joins us to share his perspective, contrasting the challenges of German forest ownership with the relative freedoms that Alabama and Georgia landowners enjoy. Welcome, Leon.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you discuss, Leon, the typical regulations and bureaucracy structures in Germany and how it does taxes and fees so we can understand what it's like?
Sure. I think the one of the most important things is that in terms of all the costs you have as a forest owner in Germany, property taxes are only a part of it. And the property taxes are probably pretty similar or even a little bit lower than they are in Alabama or Georgia. But there are a host of other fees and regulatory compliance costs that really just outstrip anything in the U.S. I mean, first of all, I've got 900 acres here in eastern Germany, right up on the Polish border. And in addition to the property taxes, I pay a mandatory membership in what's called the Water and Soil Association. And what they do is they keep the ditches clear in fields and forests to drain the water away. And of course, as a forest owner, I don't want this. I want to keep as much of the water as we get because we don't get that much rainfall in eastern Germany. And I pay $2,000 a year for the 900 acres for a service that I don't want. Another thing is what they call the Agriculture Trade Organization. And this is sort of a glorified public-private insurance company. And basically, it provides insurance for all of the subcontractors who work on my property. The thing is, they all have their own insurance anyway, so they don't need it. But this whole thing costs $6,000 a year for the 900 acres. So adding up all the stuff together with other taxes, basically, you know, it consumes about 50% of your income from any forest. And then you have the higher costs in Germany, things like diesel costs three times what it costs in the U.S. So really, the return on your investment in forestry here in Germany is about 1%. And I mean, the one advantage we've had in the last 20 or 25 years is that the property prices, the forest land prices, have increased quite a bit here. But it's a tough business. You have to love it to do it.
All right. Well, have you experienced personally situations where the German regulations prevented you from developing your forest in a way that you saw fit?
Well, I think one of the most important differences between doing forestry in, say, Alabama or Georgia or in Germany is that clear cutting is almost totally banned in Georgia, in Germany. And the maximum clear cut allowed in Germany is 5 acres, but there are so many sort of fine points and exceptions to this rule that our forestry cooperative will not clear cut more than 1 acre because they're just so concerned about the fines and the other sanctions. So this obviously makes forestry more expensive to do here and a little more complicated. A second point I think that people maybe in the U.S., where we have probably some of the strongest sort of property rights in the world, would be surprised at in Germany is that you're not allowed to post your land to keep out trespassers. So I've had people on my property yelling at me because I'm driving my truck through my own property. A couple of years ago, I had a guy pull a knife on me in the forest, claiming he was a hunter hunting on my own land. And I took a picture of him in his car. filed charges, and it was dismissed because he found out who he was, but he denied it. So it's a different world over here.
In your opinion, what do you identify as the single greatest difficulty that you face in Germany, just with the bureaucratic structures that exist?
Oh God! I mean, where should I start? I mean, there are just the new regulations. They tend to sort of come very suddenly. We have the one just regulation that came into place last year. They said that we should identify five what they termed habitat trees on every hectare. That's 2.47 acres, and they have to be physically marked, and then they also have to be sort of, you have to give the GPS coordinates for them and then turn this over to the state. And so if you add that up, I was advising a church-owned forest. It's about 7,400 acres, and they got an offer to do this work, and just to conduct this, to do this habitat tree identification, it would have cost about $100,000. And the thing is, these trees are that we mark, they're all crooked or diseased or too small. None would have been cut anyway, and they're only protected for the next 10 years. So it's just kind of ridiculous bureaucracy that costs a lot of money, involves a lot of work, but is sort of senseless in the end.
All right. Well, Leon, thank you for joining us and sharing your views. We appreciate it very much, and we certainly have learned a lot. So thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Our next guest is Crystal Gauvin with Forest Economic Advisors. FEA has developed a service that reports prices for wood products. It's called Price Plus, and she can tell us more. Welcome, Crystal.
Hi, thank you for the invite.
First, just tell us a little bit about Price Plus. What is it?
Well, Price Plus is North America's first transaction-based price report for wood products, starting with lumber and panels. And essentially, the way it works is every day a data supplier's ERP system is going to create a file of all open market transactions. And then that file is going to get sent securely to our dedicated server. And then transactions are automatically mapped from the data supplier's code to FEA's product prices. And then an average weighted price is going to be calculated. So we're looking at price and volume to get these average weighted prices. And then only those prices that have a minimum of five participants is going to be published to help protect companies' identities.
Okay. So the purpose of weighting is to make sure that it's accurate, and the not only the price, but the volume of that particular product is reported, so we get a better picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think makes Price Plus different or better than other type services?
Well, historically, price collection in wood products industry has been done by, you know, individuals, editors making phone calls. It allows people to talk up or down their position, and really no one knows how prices are being collected or how many people are being talked to. And what makes Price Pulse so different is we're using actual transactions that have occurred, and only weighted averages are reported, which means we're not guessing, we're not estimating, there's no opinion. Essentially, there's no human element with the method that we're using. Every price, as I said, has multiple participants, so we can't report a price without actual data behind it. We're also collecting prices daily, which means we can capture market changes much more quickly, and we have more accurate peaks and troughs, you know, when the market's changing directions. There's no judgment involved at any stage of the process, which can help eliminate human error, and we protect companies' identities. They're strictly confidential. The data is secure from start to finish, again, because there's no human involved in this. So I guess all that to say that Price Pulse is cheaper, it's more accurate, and ultimately it protects the industry from antitrust accusations.
Now, as I understand it, what we're talking about are wood product prices, not stumpage prices and all, but is there anything that a forest landowner can interpret or use in order to translate that into some kind of trend for stumpage prices?
Yeah, I think that there's two main buckets that of value for forest owners. So the first kind of main bucket would be that exactly what you're saying, that product prices can be used as indicators for their markets. And how does that work? Well, it can influence the value of the standing timber. So for example, when lumber prices rise, timber buyers might be willing to offer higher prices for the trees, which would directly affect the potential income for landowners. Mm-hmm. It can also help landowners optimize when they want to harvest. So again, mm-hmm. during periods of high prices, they could choose to accelerate some of their planned harvests, or on the opposite side, during times of low prices, they may want to delay a little bit. Another thing is, for those who view their forest land as more of an investment, lumber prices are going to affect both the current income potential, but also that long-term property value. So in periods of strong lumber markets, that's going to make the forest land much more attractive to future buyers. Another thing to look at is management planning. So lumber prices are going to influence the economic viability of different forest management practices. So some examples of this: higher prices might be justification for more intensive management, things like pre-commercial thinning or higher quality seedling stock. And the profitability of timber production relative to other potential land uses is going to depend partly on those lumber market conditions. So okay. I think ultimately this first bucket is, when we think about it, demand at the sawmill is going to be a good indicator of the overall health of the industry, which can help landowners calculate their profitability and return. Now this...
Okay.
That's, like I said, that's the first bucket. The second mm-hmm. bucket, and why I think Price Pulse is should be a very interesting topic right now for forest landowners, is I mentioned we're starting with lumber and panels, but chips and saw logs is our next phase that's planned. So landowners today have the opportunity to get involved as a data supplier for this product, and that means they get free access to the beta prices. They can help provide feedback and really tell us, they can help shape the report and tell us what the industry is looking for in terms of these chips and saw log price reporting across North America.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Well, Crystal, thanks for joining us. Tell us about that product. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Eric Mitchell is someone that we wanted to talk to because chronic wasting disease is now affecting several counties in Northwest Alabama. Pleased to have Eric, who is chair or co-director of the Deer Ecology and Management Lab at Mississippi State. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
Wanted to find out more about what landowners can do or maybe not do to promote health within their deer populations that exist on their property. What do you think about that topic?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we're trying to address here within the Deer Lab. One of the recent studies that we just had come out was addressing the use of deer feeders in supplemental feeding. And oftentimes, the goal of supplemental feeding is to improve the nutritional plane for your deer herd, right? Trying to improve the quality of nutrition that's available. Oftentimes, trying to increase antler size for males. So that's a pretty common reason people are going to feed. But some of the consequences of that are aggregating deer at these feeders. So the study that we just conducted really tried to better assess visitation rates of deer at deer feeders, visitation of other species like raccoons, because we're finding that they might also be spreading chronic wasting disease by while they're feeding, visiting these feeders. Just really trying to get a better understanding of what that looks like.
Okay. Well, it's a very common practice now, and one that many hunters are utilizing to have supplemental feeding programs on their property. But are there risks that come along with using the feeders to promote wildlife habitat? I mean, you've already mentioned aggregation. What does that do to the population? And is there any way that that distorts an optimum distribution of deer?
Yeah, one of the common things that we hear about deer feeders compared to things like planting a food plot or when you have acorns falling from oak trees, that deer are going to congregate regardless of where the food source is. So the study that we just conducted really was able to take a better look at that. And we found that actually deer visited supplemental feeders twice as often as they did food plots. And the contact rates, when we're talking about contact rates, we mean like nose-to-nose contact or any type of actual contact between the deer. They were also greater at deer feeders compared to food plots and feeding on mass, oak mass, or acorns, I should say, excuse me. So yeah, there certainly is a real risk there of interaction between deer at a feeder. Then that could easily help to spread diseases like chronic wasting disease.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Eric. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Many landowners know the benefit of prescribed fire, but actually getting it done can be a daunting challenge. Ryan Mitchell with Tall Timbers can help us finally get things moving with prescribed fire on our lands. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, Hayes.
What are some of the barriers that landowners face when it comes to prescribed fire?
Well, Hayes, one of the things when we talk with landowners, and it's regardless of where they're located in the country, you have four main barriers that are listed by landowners. And typically, they're in this order. It's liability, who's responsible for the fire. One of the barriers they suggest is lack of experience or lack of training. They just don't know what they're doing. They also indicate that lack of manpower, and it's something that most landowners run into. You got to have help when you're burning. It's not safe to do it by yourself. And lack of equipment. Prescribed fire utilizes specialized equipment, and it costs a good bit of money to get into it. So they list all those as barriers to reasons why they're just not burning.
Okay. Well, what do prescribed burn associations do to address that problem?
So prescribed burn associations, or some of them in the South are called landowner cooperatives, and they're basically a group of landowners that have like mind when it comes to management, and they want to pool resources and pool experience to help each other conduct safe prescribed burns. And PBAs, the successful ones that we've been able to work with, have a coordinator, and that coordinator is a paid position that helps address these barriers by conducting training, providing technical assistance during site visits, helping landowners write, not only write burn plans, but learn how they can write burn plans. And so it allows us to address a lot of the barriers that way.
All right. How do you get involved with a prescribed burn association? And do you need to have any prior experience, or can you just show up?
So the great thing about PBAs is it takes all kinds and all amounts of experience. We have landowners that have been burning for 50 or 60 years that are members of prescribed burn associations, and we have people that have just purchased land and folks that aren't landowners that just want to learn about fire and help manage habitat. So there's a place for everybody in these PBAs, and it's really being able to get out there and network together and learn from the people that have experience along with professionals that are out helping that make these prescribed burn associations successful.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Ryan. We appreciate that very much. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Leon Mangasarian, Crystal Gauvin, Eric Mitchell, and Ryan Mitchell as well. This episode of Capital Ideas took place on February 12th, the day after an impromptu press conference was held at the White House featuring the President of the United States and the richest man in the world. Elon Musk has his admirers and detractors, but in that press conference, he did outline a framework for why many Americans are frustrated by their government. One of the reasons they're frustrated is that the ideals of democracy are not operating like they should. People living in a democracy expect that the government will be accountable to the will of the people. And that process is undermined by unelected bureaucrats that are not accountable to the people. Musk equates an unaccountable bureaucracy with a threat to democracy. And in just a few words, he may have provided a context for why all levels of government must be held accountable to the people. It's an idea worth pondering, and we hope we've given you much to ponder on this in the days ahead. For AFOA, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.